Welcome to Risk Ready, presented by the Private Risk Management Association.
Welcome, everyone. This is Spencer Holden, host of Insurance Thought Leaders Podcast, a Private Risk Management Association production. On our show today, we welcome Scott Carmelani, CEO of Vault Insurance. Scott started his career at AIG, where over the course of 15 years, he held various management roles. From there, became chairman, CEO of Allied World, which was eventually purchased by Fairfax Insurance Entities. At Fairfax, he served as the president of strategy and distribution. Scott, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking the time with us. We're really excited to have you.
Thanks for having me. It's a pivotal time in the industry.
It certainly is. And you know, you and I have had several conversations in the past. One of the things that I love when I speak to you is you bring a very different perspective to the high net worth space because you have held many roles in the insurance industry and you know the industry extremely well, but you don't really know the high net worth to the same degree as some of the other players in it. And so you bring a very fresh perspective, and that's what I love. I wanted to touch on something that you and I spoke of a few weeks ago, and that was the increase of construction cost in the industry. We've talked a little bit about this on the podcast with other guests, but in a very generic way that costs are going up. And as costs go up, we've got to address both the claim side and the dwelling increase side and premium increases and profitability challenges. But you bring a different perspective in that you've really gone down a little deeper into the granular issues with cost of construction and pricing in the future and different aspects of the construction world. And where we might have seen some rises and shrinking of increases and flattening out over certainly my 33-year career, maybe those days are over and we're just in a much different environment today. Can you give me a little bit of your perspective on this issue?
Sure. Hopefully those days aren't over. It's just been a sea change, and we have to readjust the paradigm a little bit, you know, and to try not to get into sort of an economics forum here. I think you have to understand the greater issues at large that have affected the construction industry, as you mentioned, but the downside effect or the lateral effect that's had on the homeowners business and the homeowners insurance industry. I mean, it's certainly affected the commercial insurance industry as well. But though they have tools that are better suited to adjust. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you're looking at the large account commercial world, you know, 75 to 85% of that business is done through Bermuda, through entities like Bermuda or Lloyd's of London, or through not admitted carrier platforms for all the major carriers that are out there to allow for more flexibility. Not necessarily different contract or different service model or different capital model, but just a different flexibility model. And homeowners, for better or worse, gets more brought into state regulatory environments as a consumer protection class, and the admitted policy forms do their best to try to contain, volatility, for lack of a better word. And what's happened, and it's not just, you know, what's happened in the last 18 months, but really since the beginning that Vault started in 2017, and the first couple of years, not only was Vault struggling to make any money, but the whole industry was losing lots of money. That was thought to be everyone thought because there was, you know, a few years of storms back to back to back and catastrophes, it was just going to be sort of a cycle and things will return to normal. Well, what happened, as everyone knows, is we went into the pandemic, the COVID pandemic. And that sort of shut things down and sort of shut the supply chain down largely, both in the construction world and the regular production world, whether you're trying to buy a car, a house, goods at the store, inventory in general, you know, a watch. Anything that, you know, has limited production went through sort of a pause period or a slower period during the height of that pandemic. what came out of that on the backside of that was a couple of things. One, inflation, which had been dormant for a decade, if not longer, all of a sudden came up front and center. And inflation, you know, raises prices really almost everywhere. But what it did, particularly in the housing market and the homeowner space, is it caused all the contractors to readjust and reset their prices, partly because the supply chain had allowed them to take more money. You know, if you remember, plywood went from $30 a sheet of plywood to $85 a sheet of plywood in 2019. And then it started to come back a little bit, and everyone thought it would normalize. But what it normalized to was $55, $60. It didn't go back to $30 or $35. And that mentality took hold across all the subcontractors. So whether it's a plumber, electrician, a mason, the builder himself who takes his 10 or 15% commission on top of for managing the build process, all those prices increased substantially. So you had, you know, just pure cost and inflation that went up. And then you had the cost of supply, the cost of the goods and services go up. And no one in the industry was really prepared for that. I don't care which company you want to talk about, whether it's the household name brand companies that you see commercials on TV for, or the high net worth carriers. And I'm not singling out or pointing to any particular one. All of them face the same issue, whether they not they admitted it or not, that, you know, or they hoped that it would normalize and they had enough size or breadth that it would be less felt. Well, it turns out it didn't, you know, and by 2021 and 2022, that became even more pronounced. You know, take the auto industry for it's a perfect example. The prices of used cars, in many cases, actually appreciated for the first time since I started driving, you know, in the 80s. Dealers would look to buy used cars at a premium because they had no inventory of new cars. So what does that do? Think about that. You're a normal homeowner and you own two cars, or maybe you own three cars, and one goes into the shop. Not only do you go into the shop for longer because they don't have the parts, but to buy another car, the price has gone up. So the price to fix your car has gone up. And all the dealerships during that same period we're talking about started making much more money on service and selling used cars than they were ever making on new cars. And as they got used to that, that changed that paradigm. Now, there are those who think, you know, this is a cycle and there's peaks and troughs to every cycle. And I'm telling everybody who listened to me, and even people who won't listen to it, that's not coming back to what it was in 18. It might rationalize at some point, and inflation slows down and prices normalize, whatever that means. It's kind of like interest rates have gone from 2% to 6%. They're not going back to 3%. They might come down to 5% or 4%. But there's a new level, right? And that level is changing the cost of everything, whether that's settling a claim, the time to fix a home, the value of the homes. You know, I've sat in lots of producer meetings and broker meetings and customer meetings where, you know, I say to the audience, has anybody's house not appreciated 25 to 50% in the last 18 months? And while everyone loves the fact that their house is worth more, they don't want to realize or admit that, well, if they have to fix that home or rebuild that home or a portion of that home, the value of that has gone up. You know, there are builders out there who say, well, I could never build the house that you have for what you have into it today. I'd have to charge you 20, 25, 30, 40% more to do that because of all their costs have gone up. And that's really changing the model, the business model, both in terms of, you know, what the contract is designed to do and how it's actuarially priced. I mean, there's a disconnect.
Yeah, and one thing that I've noticed, especially in the high net worth space where homes have an incredible degree of detail and workmanship, very difficult to find people that understand that level of workmanship and that skilled labor that it takes to fix that home. And just supply and demand, the cost to do that work has gone up. And I agree with you, certainly with that paradigm. I don't see the younger generation learning those same skills of fine construction, and it's going to continue to be a scarcity. I mentioned in the opening that one of the things that I admire about you is the fresh perspective that you bring. And you opened my eyes to something that I hadn't really thought about. And that is just the change of the contract or lack thereof. About 25 years ago, I started working with Chubb for the first time. And the masterpiece contract that was in place 25 years ago pretty much is the masterpiece contract that's in place today. And I only use Chubb as an example because they've been in the space a little longer than everyone else. But even HO3, you know, it's gone through some iterations over the years. But I feel as though the contracts haven't really adapted to modern technology. And to some degree, maybe we've lost focus on the purpose of insurance. And we've thrown all these bells and whistles in that have put us in a degree of profitability challenges. Could you comment a little bit?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and one that should be listened to by the carriers and agents alike, because you're in fact correct. In most insurance lines of business, every few years there's a contract rewrite or at least an evaluation of the component parts of the contract, meaning the endorsements of coverage or the exclusions on the policy, relevant or irrelevant to the coverage at hand. Now, you know, we have the added dimension of filing and getting approved in every state and the rates being tied to each of the contracts, excuse me. But things that, and Chubb did invent it. The masterpiece high net worth policy form was a very, very effective and very, very powerful marketing tool for the Chubb company. And they used it very well. And it was their brand, right? You know, you get a little bit more, you pay a little bit more, and we're going to really take care of you. But some of the things that are in that policy form are not actually part of the contract or the pricing of that contract. I'll give you some examples. Temporary living expense, alternative, sometimes known as ALE, or alternative living expenses, you know, which was designed 25 years ago to be a cool marketing tool. Not just give the appearance, but to give the client something to feel good about their experience when they have a bad loss. You know, you got a fire in your house or a water leak in your house, and you have to move out for a couple of weeks or a couple of months. Contract picks up that tab because in the end, for the extra $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, you know, you're paying close to that for your insurance in the high net worth space. And you're getting something for it, and I'm going to lock you in for the next 20 years as a client, and you're going to feel good about that experience. Well, lo and behold, you know, you fast forward to today, and there are so many losses that take place today. I mean, I can't even count them all, even in our small company. So you know that all the carriers are have this issue, where that temporary living expense is no longer, you know, a few weeks or even a few months. It's a year. And, you know, people who have homes in the Hamptons or in Palm Beach County or wine country, you know, that assessment or that temporary living expense could be $50,000 to $100,000 a month in expense. Now, who's paying that kind of premium for their homeowners insurance? Very few. I wouldn't say no one, but very few. And most of the people that are paying six figures for their homeowners insurance, I can tell you from experience, have more than one home, have multiple homes even. And so the cost, that temporary living expense, which was a nice marketing idea, is not actuarially factored into the price of the homeowner's contract. And that's one example. Here's another one, which, you know, I've even had these conversations with some of the executives at Chubb. The idea of waiving the deductible when there's a large loss is a neat idea. If lightning hits your house and burns it to the ground, that family's distraught. The husband, the wife, the kids, they're totally out of sorts. Their whole life just went up in flames or smoke, literally. So why not, you know, if it's if your deductible is 50,000 or 100,000, it's going to cost me a few million. You know, what's 50, another 50 grand? So we're going to waive that deductible as a marketing tool to make you feel better about us and that experience of handling your claim. We're not going to charge you the deductible. We're not going to apply the deductible when we remodel your home or rebuild your home. That was a good idea, and it was a good marketing tool. Today, we waive deductibles for everything. And when I say we, I mean the industry. Every little thing waives a deductible. As soon as that hits that $50,000 or $100,000 mark, wherever that deductible is set, as soon as we get there, and that could be from a roof. That could be from replacing a roof. That deductible is waived. I can tell you for certain, because I've gotten deep into the sausage making, that the waiving of the deductible is not factored in actuarially or from a loss perspective, and it's costing the industry not hundreds of thousands, millions in the aggregate, and it gives no incentive for the client or the carrier to work together to try to solve that loss or problem with any speed. So it lengthens the time to get things replaced and fixed, and it puts all the onus on the carrier to pay. And we don't price for it. We don't charge for it. We don't price for it. And we do it now. In some customized deals, some of those things are being addressed. But generally, in the admitted policy form, you know, the 25-year policy that you're talking about, the admitted policy in most states, and you know, a lot of the industry copied each other in coming up with these policies. That's in there. You know, unlimited temporary expenses and waiving deductibles are freebies in the policy. You might see language that says reasonable and necessary for temporary living now instead of we just pay it. And that's not even universal. And that's a way for a carrier to say no mas when it's just getting too, you know, just out of hand. We're beyond reasonable and it's no longer necessary. So let's settle this thing and be finished with it. And there's probably the third major thing. I mean, there's little things, but the third major thing is the replacement cost value. So, you know, the policy reads that we'll pay up to 200% in some cases, somewhere between 125 and 200%, depending on what state you're in, of the cost to replace your home to fix it. We're going to fix it, even if it costs 200% more. That's a nice thing to have and a real benefit for the client. But today, with all the other things we've talked about in the last 10 minutes, that number is exponentially higher. So, you know, the average loss when it was 50 to 75 grand, now is 250 to 500,000. And that's becoming a much more expensive proposition.
Yeah, and many contracts are unlimited. And you have my wheels spinning. You know what? We used to always think that we had to do this to win the arms race and add little bells and whistles. And you're right. And everybody else would just follow suit and add the same bells and whistles. But I think we're at the point now where the consumer doesn't want the bells and whistles at the price point that homeowners insurance is costing. Totally. They're trying to find ways to do it. And as you and I have spoken about in the past, many of these clients have multiple homes. They're fine going and living in another home for 6 months. They don't want the loss of use coverage necessarily. And there's no way to peel it back. And so I think the consumer is going to start driving some of this because they're looking for a cost-effective way to transfer risk that they don't want to take. And a lot of these bells and whistles are risks that they're fine taking. You know, the other one is a cash out settlement option. I can't tell you how many clients look at their dwelling limit at $6 million and they know that the market value of their home is $3.5 million. And they're like, wow, you mean I'll get $6 million if this thing burns down? And they're like praying for lightning. I mean, it's just the wrong attitude about insurance. It's not supposed to put you in a better position you're in. So I definitely think some reforms are needed. And certainly that deductible waiver, we're already seeing multiple carriers look at it and quite frankly, change it. I think in this 2024, you'll see some contract changes that those deductible waivers will look very different. You know, I guess it's a good segue into distribution and product delivery. I feel like we're still sort of antiquated in a lot of the things we do. But have you have any observations about the modernization of delivery system or the way that we interact with the client from a digital perspective?
For sure. For sure. I mean, I could speak to vaults specifically and only anecdotally to what some of the other carriers are doing, but generally I think there's a massive race to be insure tech, and I say that in quotes, because what does that really mean? Right. Try to make the experience easier for the agent, easier for the client, have information more readily available, and to use what's known as APIs or third-party data to help both on the underwriting side and on the distribution side to fill in the blanks. So, and Vault just installed a new system right before Christmas that is demonstrably easier to use for everybody, including ourselves. So, where we used to have an application and check the address and triple check the client and there's manual entry on the agent side and manual entry on the broker side, going forward, and we're not the only ones that are addressing this, but going forward, and it's been operational for 2 months now, all we need is the address, and APIs pull in, the agent might mistakenly say it's 5 miles from the coast when they meant to say 500 feet, but the system will verify that with the address. It will pull in Google Earth and have a view of the roof. So, if they say the roof is 5 years old and it's 25 years old, there's a reckoning that takes place electronically and digitally that both creates the record and makes that record pliable, so you can make adjustments to the quotes and have different versions and save them without rekeying them all the time. The systems are being connected to the claim system so they can see their profit and loss, or how much they've paid in and how much loss has been collected in any account. And these are good and bad for the agents in a distribution system. Today when you high net worth buys their homeowners insurance and their package, if you will, their auto and their excess and all that stuff, the system issues the ID cards. It does all that paperwork. It does all that filing work where, not that long ago, only a few years ago, that either had to be, the agent had to put it into six different systems, maybe had their own system, and then try to get the carrier to help them upload some of that information. Now it's all there. It's easy and it's quick, and quite frankly, it's very efficient, and there's a lot less mistakes. So everyone becomes more efficient, and there's less keying and less error in keying. But there's more access to that same information, whether it's a submission, quote, bind, or handling a claim. But it changes what the responsibilities are a little bit, right? So, who does what and who's responsible for what? As a minor shift, and some brokers or some agents adopt it wholesale, and they're doing that work, and they're handling that efficiency and getting paid for that. Others, some of the more national stalwart agencies that have been around for 50 years, they're like, well, that's the carrier's job. We give you an application and you deal with it. But no longer do you have to do that. The digital world and the digital system, even Vault's system, you send us an ISO app or Chubb's app or Cincinnati's app and a PDF, and our whole submission platform will take that email and load the submission and prep it for quote and quote it and bind it. And when I first started in the business, I don't want to date myself, when I first started in the business, the agents held all the money. The premiums were collected by the agencies and then settled up once a month or once every 90 days or once every 60 days or once every quarter, depending on your deal with the carrier. And you, by bordereau, you settled up how much you owed. And the agents would make a little vig off of holding the money if they had a big portfolio. Today, that's all that's all digital electronic, you know, it's almost paperless, you know, it's actually more work to cut a check than it is to just, you know, hit the button on your computer and electronically transfer funds one way or the other, and no one touches it. You know, commissions are now paid out to agents rather than agents paying the net back to the carrier. So there's been some fundamental changes as to how the business transact. I think the digital world and the systems that are coming out, whether it's the tech firms that are handling the small account business, you know, the condos and apartments and, you know, $500,000 homes that you hear ads for on TV, who are, by the way, not doing so well because they thought if they had the digital solution, the client would come to them and they wouldn't need agents and brokers. Well, lo and behold, they're now in business 4 or 5 years and they're realizing it is a distribution game. And if they don't have relationships, they're still not getting you know, the volume and the market share they thought they would get, you know, compared to a State Farm or a Progressive or pick your household brand mascot who spends hundreds of millions of dollars on advertising and creates brand and has the agents loyal to that brand because their clients are asking for it because that's what they see during a football commercial on TV. And you know, they're large companies, but they're not in any better position than Vault or Cincinnati or Chubb in this world. I mean, it's not a secret that State Farm lost $12 billion last year. $12 billion. I think that's bigger than the high net worth carriers combined in revenue, never mind how much they've lost. And they're on track this year to do it again because they have not been able to turn that big ship maybe as fast as they want to or as fast as the state regulators will allow them to.
Let's make sure we get the facts straight. Given we're early into 2024, the loss that you were citing, I was correct me if I'm wrong, 2022 State Farm, $12 million, and 2023 looked like it was going the same direction.
Yeah, billion, not million.
Billion, sorry. Yes, billion. Yeah. $1 billion a month. You know, you remind me of my childhood where we're a second generation firm. And as you said, everything was agency build. And when my father and mother, my mother took care of the books, they would send out the bills and they would enclose the return envelope, which was a little blue envelope. And every Saturday morning, my father would run down the post office and see how many blue envelopes we had because they had to pay bills. And it was nice to make a little vig off of it, but it was also a lot of stress because we were responsible for any bad debt. And a lot of local townspeople would come in and say, I can't make my payment this month. And my dad was holding the thing with five kids. And definitely a lot easier now with direct bill. And you look at Europe is still very much agency build and they can't believe of our model. It's so much more efficient than what they do. Well, let's finish up. I want to hear more about Vault as we close out and we enter into a new year of 2024 and looking at the year ahead and your new role, fairly new role as a CEO. And what's the vision? How do you look to bolster your position in the high net worth space?
I think Vault's in pretty good position. We're on solid footing from a rating standpoint with AM Best, from a capital position with our shareholders and capital providers are all solidly behind the organization. No doubt we struggled in 21 and 22 with cat losses and with everything else we've talked about, which were sort of you know, straws that broke on the camel's back that made it more apparent to us than it would to you know, the large $4 or $5 billion market. So we saw it faster and we were you know, trying to figure out, well, does growing and scale solve for that? And when you got deep into the sausage making, you realized, you know, all you're doing is adding more pain, not fixing, you know, the root cause of the problems. So we've really tackled that. We've really built out the capability from a non-admitted or E&S platform, so that we can be solution oriented for our clients and provide capacity really in every market around the United States. And that, you know, that's been verified by the reinsurers. The reinsurers that support this market support a lot of our competitors as well, and our reinsurers love what we're doing, agree with everything we're trying to accomplish, and have actually are trying to provide us more capacity in the going forward market. We had a very successful renewal in 23. 24 comes up in the spring, and so far the indications have been we'll have more capacity in the future. And it's also helped that there were no major catastrophes in 2023, but that's helped everybody, right? So, you know, you can't be in a business that lives or dies on whether or not you have a catastrophe, because that's the business we're in. We're in the claims paying business. So the rest of the model has to work to not lose a lot of money. And if you can not lose a lot of money, take a little advantage of the interest rates from the investment side of it, and that is helpful, and be smart about how you proceed, both addressing your existing portfolio and pursuing new business. And I can sit here today, and we're only 3 months into January, and we're doing $1 million a week in new business.
Wow!
So it's being recognized. We're having some success. I wouldn't say it's universal around the country, but we're definitely having some success on the West Coast, the Southeast, the Midwest. You know, there are certain states that will be a challenge for a while. And when I say that, it's not just for Vault. I mean, I think the Texas regulators and the New York and New Jersey regulators have to heed some of the things that the industry is experiencing and appreciate it and understand it. And hopefully we can all get to a place where it could be, you know, a nice business for the clients, meaning they're not experiencing 20% rate increases every year, and we can find a happy medium both in terms of contract and pricing, where we don't have to feel like we're always asking for a large increase or trying to push through increases. We got to match or connect the contract with the price, because I agree with you. Look, I don't want to pay more for my homeowner's insurance than I have to, and I think it's gotten to the level where a lot of high net worth consumers are saying, wow, that's a lot of money. There's got to be an alternative, because that's too much. That's too much relative to the value.
Yeah.
Or the perceived value, anyway.
I'm looking up in the production booth, Diane Delaney. Everything okay up there?
Everything's great.
Scott Carmelani, CEO of Vault Insurance. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us today for the Risk Ready podcast. We encourage you to subscribe, download, and review our podcast. Until the next time, stay risk ready.